Just a question of clarification. You talk about anti-authoritarianism, and so you wonder if you might distinguish authority in the sense of your sense of realism versus this could be another kind of authority that is functioning in your paper. You use the phrase a couple times. Any authority, you say that of consensus. So is consensus functioning as a kind of authority differently from the way that, say, realism?
Yeah, it's yeah. Perhaps I shouldn't have called it anti-authoritarianism, but you know, some phrase to express the idea of authority other than consensus, or authority which consists in respect for the non-human, something like that. You know, I'm taking Habermas and Dewey as having the same impulse, that the only thing that a human being need respect is other human beings, and in particular that they have what Jefferson called a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, that they take tradition and consensus of interested inquirers as something worthy of respect, but take nothing else as worthy of such respect.
What about tradition?
Yeah, it's. I think Dewey was perhaps more inclined than Habermas to say human consensus is always about 99% tradition. And Habermas has always resisted Gadamer's emphasis on tradition, because Habermas thinks of it as sort of a conservative reactionary emphasis. Dewey was quite happy to say, look, you know, tradition is utterly precious. You know, it's what makes us what we are. But lately, since the Renaissance, let's say, or since the Greeks, human beings have invented this new tradition called questioning tradition, and that's what's going to save us in the end. And utilitarianism and pragmatism are the philosophical expressions of this new tradition.
Do you absolutely set your face against a way of thinking that might preface itself, at least in this context, by claiming to take on board all of the wonderful things in the pragmatist tradition?
All of the
wonderful things in the pragmatist tradition. Just to sum it up, well, yes, fine, it's a contamination of the scientific attitude to allow an assimilation of how we conceive the object that scientists want to think of themselves as responsible to something divine. Desacralized, conception of reality. But then this might be a preparatory remark from which one goes on and says, here there are ways precisely by taking on board a lot of the negative material that you're pointing to. This would be a way into giving ourselves an innocuous conception of something other than the human against which we measure ourselves. Something that's there anyway, I mean, phrases of that kind. So, yes, indeed, the idea that truth needs a capital T and reality needs a capital R, and there are deep issues about truth addressed by propounding large-scale philosophical theories like the correspondence theory. That's one of the diagnoses by this suggestion. It's a relic of a spreading of a religious attitude onto our attitude to ordinary reality. So, all right, let's not spread, but let's, on that basis, rehabilitate the idea of the real smaller as that we measure ourselves against. Reality smaller than which we measure ourselves against. Then let's give up the idea of representation, that kind of struggle. It all looks like a kind of overkill, or throwing the baby out of the bathwater, or something of that sort.
The answer to the question, do I want to rehabilitate any part of this tradition is no.
Well, I know you don't, but yeah. You set your face against the idea that might be a non-point missing response to the very things that motivate you to say, no to a lot of it.
Yeah, it's... I guess I do set my face against it, and it isn't that I have a particular reason for doing so. I'm just sort of trying to see how far I can push this, and how much you can do with this idea that what you praise scientists for is collegiality, respect for each other, rather than respect for anything non-human. See how it goes. I guess the only point at which I'd discuss a sort of rehabilitation of something like non-human authority is in the last two lectures on Saturday when I talk about your and Bob Brandom's stuff under the title, Is There Anything Left of Empiricism? Or should there be anything left of empiricism? And basically, I want to see the British empiricist tradition as something to be destroyed root and branch rather than something to be rehabilitated. But
if I could follow up, it seems to be one way of conceptualizing the large issue with which you begin is what language we ought to use to think and talk about constraint on our activities. That is, pragmatists least of all are in the business of denying that we're constrained in pursuing our happiness and securing our ends. We can see one tradition of conceptualizing that constraint in terms of the reality capital R, sort of theistic way of thinking about it. So we'd like an idiom that acknowledges that constraint, lets us talk about it without falling into the theistic way of thinking about things. It's not obvious to me that giving up the idea that we have to give up the notion of authority of things, let's say, in order to conceptualize that constraint without doing it in a theistic way, is what we think about being responsible in our claims and in our actions to the way things are, it seems to me, as a way of thinking about that constraint without worshiping it, without giving up our freedom in the good Kantian sense. As it seems to me that the Kantian idea is that our responsibilities, the things that have authority over us, have it only insofar as we've acknowledged the authority or taken ourselves to be responsible to those things. That is, that the only norms that properly bind human beings are the ones that they have freely embraced. But that when we look at things like modern technology, what we're precisely doing is acknowledging a certain responsibility to a certain constraint by the way things are. Giving them a certain authority over what we do. This is what the engineers always acknowledge the authority of things like the strength of materials over their plans. That's what
pissed Stalin off so much about them, because it was supposed to be his authority, you know, not the authority of where the trains would crash and so on. It doesn't seem to me that, that using that language of authority, of responsibility to things, need falsify that aspect of constraint on our practices, which we're apparently sure we need to acknowledge. Does that fall out of bounds?
Yeah, I'm inclined to think it is. That is, I'm inclined to think that if you start from the Kantian position that there is no authority save that freely acknowledged by human beings, what you ought to do when thinking about the tensile strength of metals, the you know, inability to overcome a given infection, stuff like that, is to think of these, you know, is not to have respect for the authority of these things, but to regard them as damn nuisances, which seems different. That is, it seems to me that when you use the vocabulary of respect for the way things are, you are using a vocabulary which suggests it is part of my moral identity to adopt a certain attitude toward these things. And it seems to me the attitude of the doctor toward the virus, the engineer toward the steel beam, isn't a matter of taking these things into account as part of, you know, being what one is. It's at least their way of doing it doesn't seem to have much analogy to, you know, respect for colleagues. And so I resist your way of doing it because the idiom strikes me as, you know, fatally infected by 400 years of tradition and capable of being dispensed with for the sake of safety, you know, that is, for the sake of not relapsing back into the bad years. But I discussed this a bit in the paper about you on Saturday morning, saying that the difference between you and Davidson seems merely a matter of idiom. Between Davidson's anti-representation, Davidson's militant anti-representationalism and Brandom's rehabilitation of the notion of representation. And the argument that I'm offering on Saturday is it doesn't really make any difference which of these two idioms you use unless you're terrified, as I am, of falling back into the religious attitude, in which case it makes all the difference. And you will prefer Davidson to Brandon.
A little more on the same line. Hack, in a paper on you, or in your response to Hack, if we invoke her distinction between background, beliefs, relevance, and what is it, justificatory practices. I forget exactly what her term is. And you say that all the good stuff, all the interesting stuff that people hope epistemologists will be able to help us with happens at the level that she relegates to background relevance considerations. Should we take A as an indication of B or not? One reason people might have for pushing this rehabilitative notion of the authority of things on you is that they worry that unless you do that, you'll find yourself saying to engineers that they don't get to talk the way they're talking anymore. You might get reasons for not wanting to have to say that to engineers. If one engineer says to another, that engineer says to another engineer, well, why don't you do it this way? And the good engineer says to the bad engineer, well, if you do that, then the bridge will collapse. Why? Well, and then you say something about how things are, something about metal, metal fatigue, and so on. Now, would it not serve your purposes simply to say, look, it's at the level of reconstruction of what they're doing, at the level of providing a philosophical gloss of why what one engineer says to another is actually justification of belief. It's there, but I want to keep out any talk on authority of things or how things are. Yeah. I have no problem with engineers invoking the natures of things to explain to each other why plan A will be good and plan B will lead to disaster.
Exactly. I mean, I want to say, at the level of, so to speak, religious practice, as kind of idealized religious practice, where the believer, the Catholic believer, takes the sacraments and says the usual creedal things about, recites the creed, including the passages about the nature of the sacraments, if there's no philosophical gloss on this, this remains as harmless as the engineers talk about, respect for the, nature of the molecule that makes up the beam and stuff like that. It is only when the question arises of possible conflict between social practices, between Stalin's politics and the engineers, between the churches, between the attraction of the church for its believers and the church's politics, things of that sort. When the social practices collide, that's when you get philosophy. And this, at least that's Dewey's claim about the nature of philosophy, that it's the kind of thing that signalizes that a couple of social practices are getting in each other's way. And so my suggestion about what the philosophers should do is, translate everything they say into terms of conflicting social practices and never allow any reference to non-human authority into the act.
As we get rid of the non-human authority, but we keep this traditional or pure authority, what is the role that plays in this change, the notion of power? I mean power and manipulation.
It seems to me that we call it power and manipulation when a social practice seems to us to have a better alternative. That is, if we have no idea about what to do about our illness except to let the doctor do what, the doctor wants to do, we don't say the doctor is exerting power and manipulating us. We say, he's taking care of us. Same goes for the psychoanalyst. If we have no better idea what to do about our craziness, we do what the psychoanalyst tells us. When we do think we have a better idea, even a vague sketch of an idea, then we begin to say with Foucault, maybe that's the old social practice is just power, not just power, but we describe it as power and manipulation. But this is an insult that doesn't occur to us until an alternative is at hand.
Just a comment on Jones' dimension of your response. I think it's going to come with the rehabilitated conception of philosophy in a way alternativists have been pushing at you. But it's going to be incumbent on a philosopher who says this kind of thing about what it means to do to withhold any suggestion that by saying these philosophical things, look, they are conceding authority to the materials themselves or something of that sort. The philosopher is somehow making it better, producing a validation, showing that it's really all right. I mean, this is merely a comment. It's not an offering of our services to to make it be clearly all right in a way in which it was not clearly all right earlier. This is just, you know, another attempt to depict the idea that it's possible to rehabilitate, for instance, the vocabulary of conceding authority to the things themselves from being tainted with the kinds of things that you're pointing to. I wanted to say something mildly frivolous, but that leads into. It seems very peculiar to accuse you of intellectual timidity, but your reaction to Bob certainly made it quite tempting to do that. I mean, the rehabilitative move is a bold move. Yes, all right, the language is dangerous, but we know how to fix it so that it doesn't land us in those swamps. And you're the one who's saying, but I don't know.
Yeah. I think the question that I want to discuss when I take up random stuff between him and Davidson is how much respect for common opinion, how much avoidance of paradox is best suited to get the job done. That is, the difference between a fervent repudiation of all representationalist metaphors, as in Davidson, and an attempt to say, look, they're not as bad as you might think, as in Brandom, I regard as a practical question about therapeutic strategies. And I'm going to try to argue that every philosopher, even Brandom, has to say some paradoxical things, and the only nobody is going to improve the intellectual situation of a culture without paradox, because if Wittgenstein were right, if everything were fine just as it is, then there would you wouldn't need any kind of cultural critic, you wouldn't need any kibitzing on social intellectual problems. So my argument in the Davidson Brandom case is Brandom has as many paradoxes as Davidson and shouldn't be afraid of a few more. But it's all a matter of more or less, so to speak. I mean, what you want is a view that is sufficiently attractive to get people to swallow a few paradoxes as, the bitter pill you have to take for the cultural cure. And that Anglophone philosophy, I think, has been too tempted to say, our job is to eliminate paradox, to leave everything intact, to rehabilitate all pre-philosophical opinion. I don't think there is a nice clean break between philosophical and pre-philosophical opinion. I think our so-called common opinion is the residue of the intellectuals of the past, including the philosophers. So I think that there isn't a court called common sense or avoidance of paradox to be appealed to.
I'd like to say two things that I think, at least at first sight, seem to militate in opposite directions. One goes your way, the other goes Dow's way. Let's see what you think of it. The way I understood what your response to the suggestion that the philosopher rehabilitating the notion of respect for how things are, our dealings with them, is this. That if we conceive of philosophy as a fundamentally seam of clashes of practices, there are no innocent comments of that sort. The rehabilitated notion will serve in this process of trying to work out a compromise or adjudicate between even perhaps settle which way we should go. I, we should delimit these practices. And therefore, the appeal to something other than those practices is really a kind of, is a mystification. It serves as a way to settle the practice, and it's particularly dangerous, or settle the conflict. It's particularly dangerous when it doesn't present itself in those terms. It presents itself as a simply a comment, a neutral comment, rehabilitating vocabulary. So therefore, we should resist it, even the rehabilitative. But you could also say, well, we have this vocabulary, or we are working, finding our way in this vocabulary, and we can fear it, and we can decide to try and set it aside, and therefore not use those notions anymore. But the problem with that is that since philosophy is precisely a scene for clashes of cultural practices, the reason why this vocabulary is there and why we feel held by these problems are reasons that have their roots outside philosophy. So if we as philosophers decide, well, let's just set it aside and not talk that way anymore, we are refusing to engage problems that are rooted outside and therefore will persist and do whatever they do to us, now unaddressed even by philosophers who refuse to try and work through the vocabulary. I mean, a vocabulary is something that really only emerges for us as a vocabulary once we have, in a way, set in mind.
Once we have
said,
said goodbye to it. Yeah.
Worked our way through it. But abandoning it by actually will, before we can work our way through it, leaves it to do all the work that we as philosophers are supposed to try and get clear on, so that we can do a kind of cultural, play the role of cultural critics or compare the practices. And so if that kind of thinking is right, then that would seem to militate against a sort of blanket refusal to fix or change or improve the vocabulary or keep working through the conflicts that manifest themselves in it, precisely because philosophy is not autonomous.
I obviously have to buy both sides of the antithesis and say that, you know, philosophers are continually conducting experiments in how much they can get away with, you know, how much non-commonsensical talk they can make current among the vulgar. And it's amazing how much success they've had. You know, you wouldn't have thought these people would be able to, influence the way people talk, but in fact, this need for showing people how to reconcile social practices is appreciated by the vulgar, and they often do change their habits in, you know, only a century or two, let's say. So I guess all I can say is to echo Dewey and say you can't have a position of, you know, you can try to get rid of something entirely and see if it works. It may come back in through the window, in which case your experiment failed, but, you know, it was worth a try.
I would like to say something about two typical objections which I meet when I try to present your views publicly. The first objection is connected with the way in which you treat religion as a private business, so to speak. People say that a religion cannot be compared with collecting stamps, that religious beliefs are something more than collecting stamps, that you cannot have religious beliefs and treat it as something absolutely private, because there is a difference in quality between collecting stamps and having religious beliefs. That's a very typical argument which I meet very frequently when I try to discuss this thing. And the second thing is connected with the way in which you treat consensus. Because if we take into account Habermas, we can see that he tries to defend consensus using some very strong philosophical tools. So what if we can imagine such a situation that we have consensus, the universal consensus, and that the result of this consensus is evil, simple evil. And if we
simply, if we have no alternative for this consensus, what about with good and with truth and everything? Because you presuppose that we have such a situation in which we have plurality, and that's okay. But what if we imagine the situation in which plurality is simply vanished and we have a consensus which produces evil?
On the second question, it seems to me that you can imagine Dewey saying, look, I'm not, Dewey and Habermas saying, I'm not going to use the term consensus unless there's been, you know, consideration of alternatives of sufficient intensity so that people can still toy with alternatives. And, you know, I think when people say, look, you could have a Nazi consensus, Habermas is going to say, look, a Nazi consensus isn't a consensus because it isn't people asking about, you know, alternatives and coming to agree. It's people not knowing there's an alternative. And we have, I take it, on the Habermas-Dewey view, more communicative reason and more democracy, precisely insofar as we have more alternatives being contemplated in more areas. So, you know, you don't have communicative reason or democracy unless you have sort of endless conflict on everything. But I take it this is just Hegel's point that, you know, you got to have as many antitheses going as possible in order for the spirit to do what spirit is supposed to do. Well, on the first question, I think the proper analogy, or the analogy I want anyway, is not between religion and stamp collecting, but between religion and love and marriage. That is, you know, it does sound offensive to say it's a hobby. It doesn't sound offensive to say one's relation to one's religious faith is like one's involvement with one's lover, spouse, and so on. There is an obvious sense in which it is nobody else's business what the character of that involvement is, but that doesn't make it a hobby. To extend the analogy in another direction, the reason people are suspicious of religion is because, in Habermas's terms, it encroaches on other cultural spheres, notably politics and science. And one could say that, you know, insofar as love and marriage encroach on a person's politics or science, they have a bad marriage or, you know, an unfortunate relationship. To try a third tack, I guess I would say, in the last 300-400 years, it has become gradually more and more intelligible to think of religion as nobody else's business. It didn't used to be intelligible. I mean, in the 16th century, if you said, my religion is none of your business, this would be merely paradoxical, you know, because, you know, figuring out what religion somebody had was sort of, you know, the first thing you had to know and getting, you know, getting on terms with them. It isn't anymore. Just like who you're married to isn't the first thing you have to know. But, you know, I think, you know, our use of the term religion has changed in the course of the gradual secularization of culture, the rise of religious tolerance, you know, all the usual stuff, and now we can talk perfectly well about religion as something which, you know, something about which it is perfectly reasonable for people to say that's none of your business.
So, not in each country.
Not in each country, sure. Yeah, but I think that just illustrates Dewey's point that, you know, political philosophy is first philosophy. That first you start out thinking what kind of, you know, what's your ideal culture, country, system, something like that. And then you ask yourself, okay, in order to get that kind of country, culture, or system, what kind of views about this, that, and the other thing do you want? And that's what Dewey was doing. That is, he was starting out by saying, here are the things I like about American democracy and want to encourage. What views on such topics as knowledge, truth, God, and so on would encourage these cultural trends?
Well, I wonder if you think about the religion the way pietists like Kant, but particularly Hegel did, where religious community is what people have been darkly talking about in terms of spiritual things all along. Whether the best Deweyan rubric for your attitude towards religion isn't something like freedom of association rather than privacy. That is, the right to have a communal rather than a private, at least in the narrow sense of private, a right to have a communal involvement that isn't a civic involvement, insofar as it doesn't collide. Yeah. And it's an equally sort of social undertaking, but can't we do that sideways on to the joint undertakings that our fellow citizens have a right to have rights over us, and our fellow believers may have rights over us too, but that's because we freely have to deal with the community and given them those rights. And I just wonder if the rhetoric of privacy, keeping misleading, and just the way the previous question suggested, where something like freedom of association, which is there's a straightforward democratic
solution.
Couldn't be most of the same thing.
Yeah, you can certainly do it that way if you throw in the provision that freedom of association includes the freedom to associate with nobody if you don't want to. And, you know, if a religious community can get down to one person, fine. Then you, as it were, take away the obnoxious aspects of communitarianism and say, you know, communities should be as large or small as they feel like being, or to put it more politically, the state or the society in general should not have any views about what constitutes an association or a community. In the case of academic freedom, this comes down to saying, you know, if you have a department of X, which is the only one of its kind in the world, you don't necessarily suppress it, you know, because, you know, for the same reasons that you don't necessarily suppress a church which demands public funds, even though it has only three members, you treasure these little enclaves. So I agree that, you know, if you overdo the privacy bit, it sounds a little weird. And probably you're right, freedom of association with this corollary or with this addendum makes more sense. Yeah.
But what you do with a religion that involves practices that many people think are improper or are illegal, like animal sacrifice or female mutilation or forbidding others to have abortion or using drugs, any of those things, it's rather hard then to say that they're just a private matter.
I think that it's, I think again, all you can do is say, democratic societies actually have had considerable success in negotiating these issues. And yeah, they don't, you know, a democratic society, a pluralist democracy doesn't give any religious group everything it asks for. It can't. But it can figure out just how much it can give it. You know, the Quakers can be given alternative service in time of war. Catholic doctors can opt out of abortions, you know, stuff like that. And this means that the line between the political and the religious is always going to be blurred, but that's okay. You wouldn't expect it not to be.
Yeah,